Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week I'm talking yet again to John DeLeo and about his book Screensavers 2, which, as in the, is the great cinematic tradition, is a follow-up to Screensavers 1.
Of course.
It's the sequel. It's subtitled My Grab Bag of Classic Movies. I know John seems to have watched every film A, B, and possibly even C on the billing since the first heliotrope or whatever it was flickered across the silver screen. How come you missed these the first time round? Are these the second pressing, or are they just ones you didn't have time to deal with in your first book?
Well, as you said, it is a sequel to Screensavers, which the subtitle of that one was 40 Remarkable Movies Awaiting Rediscovery. And I'd written more than we actually used. So there are 10 more, you know, detailed, extensive, long pieces about overlooked movies. It wasn't that they weren't good enough for the first one, it was just the way we arranged it. These were the ones we decided to use another time, and this is the time. But in addition to that, it's the midsection of the book is a collection of blog posts of mine over the last 3 years, newly organized by category. And then the third section is a sequel to my first book, which was my film trivia book, And You Thought You Knew Classic Movies. So that's a sequel in terms of brand new quizzes. And that original book is going to be coming out in an e-edition in this coming winter. But to answer your question, it's not that these are ones I've seen since then. It was sort of just more that I thought of that I wanted to share with readers. Because you really don't ever run out of movies, even if you think you've seen them all. There's always somebody to discover, whether it's an actor or a director or a writer. And then you think, I can't believe I never saw this batch of movies. And you really, even with really good ones, you seem not to run out of them, which is a wonderful thing for people who love movies.
Yeah. Well, but some of them, are they really worth revisiting, or is it just historical value? Wow, look at this turkey.
No, I think
frozen in aspic.
No, definitely worth revisiting for quality. Although, I mean, I do have one chunk in the middle called They Can't All Be Gems, which is a series of pans of mine, because just because they're old, just because we call them classic in quotes, doesn't mean they're all good. And there are quite a few terrible ones from every year, of course. But no, what I have included mostly out of, because of the quality, the high quality of the movies, not just because there's some interesting historical.
Well, I noticed that section, Why Can't They All Be Gems? They were all pretty old films that you were.
Well,
you
primarily
produced.
Have made sort of my subject in general what we call the golden age of Hollywood, which, you know, you could decide exactly what that means, maybe a little bit different. It has a little bit different meaning for different people, but generally the 30s, 40s, and 50s, I guess you'd call, which is really the studio system. So the golden age was sort of the heyday of the studio system, and that's mostly what I write about. So yeah, most of the movies in all of my books are pretty much from that period, although obviously with the Tennessee Williams book I did, Tennessee Williams and Company, that's when we first talked on your show. That obviously was primarily 50s and 60s. And my book, 100 Great Film Performances You Should Remember But Probably Don't, went all the way to 2000. But generally, my area is that golden age. And then certainly in this book, I'd say predominantly that's what's covered. Although I have a section on the Oscars, which is mostly about the last few years of the Oscars and sort of dissecting what goes on there.
Yeah, it would be difficult to vivisect it because there's so little life some years.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was just an erudite throwaway line that suddenly occurred to me. one of the gems you revisited, as I see, is the African Queen. I thought that was a sort of established way up there in the canon there. What was the purpose of the revisit, apart from to...
I think every once in a while, like I said, since I primarily write about movies that maybe aren't household names in terms of popularity. Every once in a while, I like to throw in a revisiting of a classic. And in the book, I revisit a number of movies of the caliber of The African Queen that I assume most people have seen. And it's in most cases, in that case, certainly, I praise it to the skies that it is every bit as great as we thought it was then, and we've continued to think over these last six decades. It's just two of the greatest star actors of all time giving two of their greatest performances in a beautifully written and directed piece. It's just an extraordinary movie, and I just saw it again and was excited about it, wanted to do a piece about it. It is one of my all-time favorites.
How much of a barrier to modern audience is the black and white? I mean, you see Casablanca, and of course the cinematography, the black and white is stunning. In fact, you see even more recently something like Dr. Strangelove, and it'd be difficult to envisage that in anything other than black and white. But recently we went to see Frankenweenie with a four-year-old, and he wanted to know, you know, where were the colors, Daddy? Where were the colors?
Sure. It's I wish people use more black and white more today. And usually if they do, it's as in something like The Artist, where it's about a period that we associate with black and white. So to recreate that feeling, we go back to black and white. But I wish people would use it in contemporary movies more, because it can be quite stunning. And I know there is a stigma about it, as if it's a cheap way out, or they couldn't afford it, they didn't have enough imagination to dream up the colors. Extraordinarily inventive. Yeah.
But being British, of course, we remember some of the classic British movies of the 60s were being shot presumably on economy grounds. Think of Hard Day's Night or The Knack or Morgan, A Suitable Case for Treatment. Brilliant pieces of filmmaking, but because they were in black and white at the time when anyone who could afford it was doing color, people neglect them.
Well, even in America, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was sort of the last major American black and white movie of that, you know, if you go from the beginning of time up to that point, and then it sort of fell away completely. Until, I guess, sort of the Last Picture Show would be the first time a major movie had black and white again. And again, that was to evoke the early 1950s. It was a choice, again, for the ambiance. But all the way up to 1966, they were still using it. As you said, Dr. Strangelove, of course, The Apartment in 1960. Black and white was still a viable way to go. And people either accept, oh, this is black and white, or this is color, without making a judgment on the very fact of it.
But the other sort of positive aspect is that with modern technology, between MP3s and free downloads from Amazon and the classic movie channels, etc., at one time you had to wait for some art house to revive some sort of flickering celluloid before you could see these things. But now they're available almost at the flick of a keyboard.
Well, that is a wonderful aspect of the modern age, is the availability of films of all times. Because I remember as a teenager in the 70s how rare it was to be able to see things. And if it was showing in the middle of the night on television, I would set my alarm clock to get up and watch it before the VCR, before, you know, recording in any kind of way. And now if you're a young person interested in classic films, you've got Turner Classic Movies and the Fox Movie Channel, plus the DVD availability and Netflix and all of that. It seems like it's the heyday of being able to see stuff. Now, of course, there's the argument of what you're seeing it on, meaning it'll be unlikely that you're seeing it on the big screen that was meant to be seen, and the devices are getting smaller and smaller. But that's the flip side, I guess, of the availability of seeing it on
funnily enough,
relatively small.
We had the tiniest of televisions until I sort of, in Hong Kong, I bought the disc of Lawrence of Arabia and decided we had to buy a big television, because otherwise it would look like the camels going across the dunes would look like one of those primitive tennis games. You just see these little dots bouncing up and down. So,
Right, that's the classic example of the movie that you have to see on something bigger than a wristwatch. Yeah, that's the one you really want to see in the biggest screen possible. Yes, absolutely, Lawrence of Arabia.
Those dunes just don't cut the mustard on an iPhone. I don't. In fact, a lot of those big bioepics, you know, sort of trying to watch the chariot race in Ben Hur, or even the Zulus charging in the Zulu would be very difficult on a small screen.
Sure, and of course, once television came in, that was the big thing in the 50s, to make movies bigger than ever, to have something to draw you away from your television set. So that's when, you know, CinemaScope and of course, the chariot race, again, a classic example of something that was designed for an enormous screen to just knock you out.
I haven't gone as often as I used to, but the Ziegfeld and the one on 60th Street where I used to go for the revival of Spartacus and things like that glorious CinemaScope.
Yeah.
Hey, but that was a different era. I mean, actually had intervals, intermissions.
Oh, yeah. It was sort of a little pretentious in a lot of the cases because, in fact, I recently watched the remake of Goodbye, Mr. Chips with Peter O'Toole. He's very good in it, but it's not a very good movie musical, but it's got the overture and the intermission and the on-track and the exit music, and it's sort of to give it a sort of a touch of class, but it was very common in the 60s to give it all those bells and whistles, even if the movie ended up being a dud.
Yeah, but I mean, you've got to think, it ties into the technology we're talking about, doesn't it? We're talking about a different experience in those days. To go out to a performance like that was like going to the opera. It was like going to Broadway.
Yeah.
Whereas now,
exactly, recreate that excitement of a special event, you know, a special event movie. And when the movie was really good, it really was a special event, like a Lawrence of Arabia. But some of them, when they started not making money, something like Goodbye, Mr. Chips and a couple of other very expensive box office failures, that started to fall away. And then in the 70s, it got so much grittier, and sort of movies changed completely.
What equipment do you do your watching on? Do you have a high definition screen the size of a bedroom, of a living room wall, or do you have a projector?
I probably should, and I'm almost embarrassed when I say that I don't. But I have I don't know if it's 24 inch or whatever. You know, it's a decent size, and I tend to sit very close. But I'm more interested in just knowing that the ratio is correct. Like if I'm watching a widescreen movie, I want to make sure it's letterboxed. As long as I'm seeing the whole thing, I'm not crazy about bigger, 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 as long as I'm seeing everything. So I think that's usually the most important thing, because that was always the argument. I guess that argument's ended by now, but when people didn't like seeing things letterboxed because of the black panels on the screen, they felt they were getting less of the movie when they were actually getting more of the movie. But I think Turner Classic Movies has shown the audience that that's the way to go, since they'll show everything in the proper ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And again, in the days of the 70s, everything was shown in the very bad, the terrible ratios with the pan and scan and commercials. And it was a very challenging time to educate yourself on classic movies in the 60s
and 70s. Well, that's the other thing that
showed so little respect, you know, for the work.
I think my favorite introduction to American and commercial. In Britain, the commercial breaks were rigorously segregated. They were every quarter of an hour. It would say end of part one. It would clearly say, you know, this is the commercial break. The commercials would come and then they'd return. And here, I think it was Prayer for the Dying, where the church falls down on the terrorist's head. And it immediately cut without any sort of break for a Band-Aid advert, and I thought, no, this is it's somewhat inappropriate. It's going to take more than a Band-Aid to restore that fractured skull.
Right, every 17 minutes the commercial came in, no matter what or whatever it was. But yeah, there was very little respect, and you just sort of accepted it at the time. But now, like I said, at least those channels of Chuck Classic Movies are very respectful of the way in which they're seen, and that's great. And there's the fact that they brought back, you know, whole libraries of movies, because again, I guess certainly I can account for the 60s and 70s. They were really about, you know, a few hundred movies that played on television all the time. essentially the classics with the biggest stars. And something like Turner Classic Movies or the Fox Movie Channel, they brought out all these movies that hadn't been on television in years, if ever. And you can really educate yourself on any individual person you're interested in if they happen to belong to that studio and they've got all their movies. It seems like Paramount Pictures is the one that we don't actually get to see their library. That's like the Bing Crosby movies and the Veronica Lake movies of 30s and 40s kinds of movies from Paramount that don't really have a place to be shown right now. So that'll be the next big wave we're waiting for. And again, there'll be little gems that we'll discover and think, wow, this is really good. We should know about this. And you'll see a lot of junk, of course. So, but it'll be exciting. Like I said, there are always more movies, even when you think you're...
Well, as a science fiction fan, there comes a point where the junk is almost delicious in its own right, isn't it?
Oh, of course. Well, there's a certain kind of wonderful bad movie that it can be enormously pleasurable. Certainly, a lot of that's the sci-fi stuff from the 50s. Some of them are actually really good, like The Thing and Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Day the Earth Stood Still. But, of course, the junkier sort of grade C movies can also be fun with the sort of bad monsters, the cheap monsters. See the effects plainly.
Yeah, so couldn't somebody tuck down that duct tape on the corner of the monster?
Exactly. Right, the back, the seams in the back coming apart or something like that, right?
Yeah, but even then, there's a glory. I mean, it's like the early Star Trek series where, you know, people would fall into polystyrofoam rocks which would move when they hit them.
Well, I guess that was a case of writing over budget, you know, that they had good scripts.
Yeah, I regarded that as Shakespearean. The sets were not the thing.
Yeah. That's the way to put it, yes.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I'm talking again to John DeLeo about his book Screensavers 2, my grab bag of classic movies. And he's detailed so many that we're actually sort of discussing the theme of the book rather than the specifics in it. So are there any recent ones which revered as classics which you want, since we're close to Thanksgiving, you want to turkey-fy?
Well, this is, of course, the big movie season approaching where everybody releases the movies they think are going to be the big awards getters, you know, in the winter. So suddenly, you know, after there being a dearth of good things to see through so many stretches of the year, then suddenly you can't see things fast enough because now every time a Friday comes, there are two things you'll want to see, and it becomes a little overwhelming because then by March there'll be nothing to see. And I'm just beginning to start to see them. So I did see Argo. I like that one very much, the Ben Affleck movie. Haven't yet seen Lincoln, which, of course, is the next big one to see. And so, you know, we'll see. It always looks terrific when you look at the slate of what's to come. And then, you know, you're bound to be disappointed in some, and there'll be some that are better than expected. And I mean, last year, although the artist was the one that got all the attention, I actually preferred Hugo, which was also another movie that was celebrating our cinematic past, but I found that one much more inventive and moving, and it stayed with me in a much more, I don't know, personal way, or I was much more affected by it. So that was a movie that I really loved.
And now I'm going to come in with an accusation of insularity. I'm looking through here, and where are all of the great French and Russian and British and Spanish movies? Why haven't you given them any treatment? You've given some of them a sort of British mid-Atlantic, of course.
I have a nice piece, a large piece in the beginning on The Fallen Idol. It's a great British film, one of my favorites. So that's, I'm not making excuses. I think it's only because I tend to have made American movies my subject just because of my better familiarity with them. I certainly have written about other British films. What I'm saying, I basically stick to English language films just because I think it's more my area of expertise. I occasionally will write about other movies. I wrote a long piece about The Umbrellas of Cherbourg in the first Screensavers. I guess I know there's a lot of great foreign films that I haven't seen, so I guess as I build up my experience with them, I'll be more likely to do larger pieces about them and maybe even a book about them. But, I mean, I've seen, I guess, the major works that we would consider the major works of European filmmakers of the mid-century, but I'm not as familiar with all the other ones around them. So every once in a while I discover a director that I'm not really that familiar with. And then again, you want to see all their work. But like I said, there's so many movies to see. And I am so interested in American films of that golden age. And I never seem to run out of them. And I get sort of caught up in one actor and want to write a lot about that person.
Well, that's what I was about to ask. I mean, thematically, when you're looking at these, do you go by director, by producer, or by actor?
I think I've always basically gone through actors. I think it's because my initial interest was in acting, and that's what I wanted to be when I was a young person and starting out as an adult. So I think when I made the transition to writing, my way in, my most comfortable way of writing about film was acting because it was the thing I knew best. So I tend to like to explore what actors do and, you know, what they're responsible for and what maybe the director's responsible for, or track how an actor charts his performance from the beginning to the end and what he or she brings to it, and how he develops that role throughout the course of the film. And it's always fun to discover people that you think were underappreciated. My particular favorite is Joel McRae, who was a very sturdy, reliable American actor of the 30s, 40s, and 50s into the early 60s, but wasn't particularly highly touted. He was just a good old reliable. And because he was so taken for granted, you can now see that it was unfortunate. He didn't happen to make it look so easy that he was taken for granted. He didn't, you know, do accents and wear funny noses and try to impress you with his acting with a capital A. He just sort of did his job perfectly, and it looks very modern now because he's so naturalistic and he doesn't seem to be trying very hard. So someone like that really jumps out now. Not that all those showier actors weren't terrific and that they still don't look terrific, but some of those people fell through the cracks. And when you find someone like that, for me, as a writer about film, I get to, you know, talk about my latest passion and sort of share that. And you feel like you may be opening up other people to some of these great people and some of their great films.
It's funny, last week I went to see at the National Arts Club, the Shakespeare Guild, director Nigel Jackson. Had a really, by the way, I should recommend this to people. It's one of the great bargains, the Shakespeare Guild. You have incredibly illuminating and entertaining speakers. It's free and it's in the National Arts Club. Wonderful ambiance. But he was making the point, one of the reasons that he'd stopped becoming an actor and went to director was, I was thinking of it in terms of film, was that, you know, once you've set it up, just doing the same stuff every night on the stage just doesn't cut the mustard for him. Whereas with the director, you know, you direct it and it's a one-off, and, you know, you've launched it and it's finished.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that although the best film actors tend to have worked the stage as well, but there must be this sort of, you know, this is a complete performance, whereas you have this irregularity about doing it on the stage. The audience changes or how you are, but with film, it sort of strikes me it must be much more fulfilling in a way, unless you like the audience.
Well, you've heard from different people with their different opinions as to their preferences. I mean, Marlon Brando's an interesting example because he became a star on the stage doing Stanley and Streetcar. And then, of course, he does the film version. It's his second movie, and he never went back to the stage. So as great as he was in those few Broadway shows that he did in the 40s, apparently, he was obviously a film animal, and that's what he was born for, because he hated doing the same thing the same way more than once. And even apparently when he was doing Streetcar on Broadway, he was known for doing all kinds of different things every night, sometimes unsettling the other people on the stage because they didn't really know what he was going to do, which can be very exciting, but you can see how it would be frustrating if you're in the play with him. But as a film actor, he sort of found his medium where he could do it. I don't know how many takes necessarily, but he would do it a different way each time and come up with something and not have to you know, dredge it up 8 times a week. And whereas some people prefer the stage because you get to start from the beginning of the character's arc and go all the way to the end in order, because the frustrating thing with film is you never know where in the story the next scene will be, where we're going to shoot the end first, then the middle, then back to the end, then a little of the beginning. And it can be disconcerting because you have to keep reminding yourself where you are. And you may change your mind about things, but you can't go back 2 months ago when they've already, that set has been, you know, struck down and you're on to something else. So
well, one of the great sort of cinematic traditions, which you have failed to cover in your chauvinistic way, is of course Bollywood in India. And I understand that one of the problems there was that they took so long to make some of these films that the actresses were sort of ballooning and shrinking depending on how close they were adhering to their diet in the course of the film.
Sure.
So, you know, she come in like a balloon puffed up with ghee and curry one day and then be svelte and maiden-like the next.
Well, there are stories in American films, too, of, you know, that kind of thing where if some books will tell you to look out for that in certain things, or a pregnancy that's being hidden as the movie was proceeding, you know, and people are standing behind things or have feather boas in front of them just to take your mind off of that.
The evidence. So looking at all of these, are we in a great age of cinema, or is it the special effects over computer-generated overcoming the need to do the story and the acting?
There are always terrific movies every year. There are always great performances every year. I guess what's a little depressing sometimes is just that the range of the kinds of movies being made seems smaller in terms of there are so many special effects blockbusters. There are so many movies for children that, you know, you have to wait till November, it seems, for the grown-up movies to come out, and they're all bunched up at the end of the year. So I think I wish there was a little more variety. But the other thing is, you don't really know what kind of age you're in until it passes and you look back. Certainly now, at least the first half of the 70s is regarded as the second golden age, but I don't know that we were thinking in those terms while it was happening. It's sort of a little time has to pass. Even when you see a movie and you love it, I always wonder, well, what will I feel about it in 5 years, 10 years? You know, things change in the culture. We as people change and we respond differently. So that's why it can be really fun to revisit things, because it's the same, but you change and you identify with different characters as your life progresses. And it's a fascinating experience, you know, the arts in general, what we learn about ourselves from our contact with them.
And of course, one of the fixed points about this is the movie prices keep going up, the ticket prices, as I notice when I take the children. And I remember being in New York when every time a commercial appeared during the cinema, people who paid the ticket price started hissing and booing, and somehow they overcame that, if you remember. They made little mini movies for Coca-Cola and introduced it by the back door.
I think we gave up the booing because we knew it was a losing battle. It's getting pretty steep. And certainly when you add the 3D, which is becoming more and more prevalent, but that's another with the $4 on every ticket or more.
Well, look, John, this is all we have time for, I regret to say. I've enjoyed this rambling discourse. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I've been talking to one of our regulars, John DeLeo, about his latest book, Screensavers 2, My Grab Bag of Classic Movies. Go grab it. Thanks, John.
Thanks so much, Ian. Thank you.
Listen in next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.